Hey everyone, quick question relating to one of the stories that's going to be in tonight's video. Do you believe in evil spirits or kind of anything like that? And do you believe that they can attach themselves to someone or maybe an object? Do you think objects and people have a certain energy that something of a supernatural type can hold on to? And follow someone and cause mischief and all kinds of other horrible, terrible things. I'm really, really interested to see what people think. I don't personally believe in the paranormal per se, but I don't know. Sometimes I definitely get the vibe that there's something out there and it has it out for me. Let me know what you think in the comment section down below. And once this video is done, let me know what you thought about the stories as well. Enjoy. The House Spider. 3 weeks ago, I went to go see my best friend Kimiko in Japan. I recently had problems with a guy I dated, Jet, turned stalkery when I broke things off, and I wanted some time away dealing with that. More importantly, I was excited both because I've never been to the country, or much of anywhere, and I hadn't seen her in person since a few weeks after college graduation, which had been almost 5 years ago. She had lived in Tokyo for a couple of years when she moved back, but when her grandmother had died, she inherited the woman's home out in the country about 20 kilometers of Osaka. It was a large house that had been in the family for generations, and based on the picture she had sent me, I was excited to stay in such a neat place too. She came to pick me up at the airport, and after hugging and talking excitedly for a few minutes, we headed to her car. She seemed just the same as she always had. Smart, funny, full of life, but I knew her too well. I could see something was worrying her as we drove through the beautiful countryside, her pointing out this cool thing or that historic site with a fluidity that made me wonder if she was making up some of the facts and names as she went. I laughed inwardly at the idea of her making up tourist facts, but when she took a break from pointing things out, I asked her if everything was okay. She glanced at me with a nervous smile. You always do that. Yeah, everything's okay, but I've been debating on when to tell you about the unique feature of my house. I've been smiling back, but I felt the expression slipping away at her tone. What's that? Well, you know this is an old house, right? My great-great-grandparents built it over 100 years ago, and I'd never been to it while my grandmother was alive. I could tell she was trying to build up her courage to get it out, and before I could respond, she finally did. Well, the house is kind of haunted. Kinda not really. Her voice went up at the end like she was asking me for confirmation. I raised an eyebrow. I'd expected her to say the plumbing was bad or that the wiring was wonky. Not this. And kinda? What did that even... What I mean is, it's not a ghost. It's a yokai. Which I can tell you don't know what that is. Okay, it's a general term for a wide variety of creatures and spirits in Japanese folklore, and apparently they're real, at least some of them, because I have one. I felt disoriented. I'd have thought it was a practical joke, but Kimiko hated pranks, and I could tell that she was serious. I considered if she was on drugs or having a mental issue, but knowing her, that seemed unlikely too. So I decided to just roll with it. Okay, weird. So, what kind of thing do you have? Can you see it? She nodded slowly. Oh yeah. And it sounds way creepier than it is. It's just a really big spider. Unexpectedly, a burst of laughter pushed its way out of my throat. Fuck, I thought you were serious. Kimiko was frowning and shaking her head, her eyes going between me and the road. I am. And it's not really a spider, at least not a normal spider, but it's about the size of... well, like that show Lassie. It's about Lassie-sized. And it's lived there since the house was built, at least according to the letter my grandmother left when she died. It doesn't hurt or bother anything or anybody, and most of the time it stays out of sight. Occasionally it'll come out to watch TV if I have it on. Likes game shows for some reason. But the thing is, it keeps the house immaculate. Blinked. Your border collie-sized spider ghost is a maid? She shot me a look. Not a ghost, a spirit, or a part spirit, or whatever. But yes, it cleans. Never when you're around, and it has to be through magic, but I haven't had to lift a finger since I moved in. I turned in my seat to face her more directly. Okay, what's the deal? Is this a joke about me being messy? I don't get it. She sighed. I know how this sounds, but I didn't want you being terrified when you saw it. And you know I never would have invited you here if I didn't truly believe it was safe. It was weird for me at first, too. Now I kind of look at it like having a fucked up family dog that doesn't die. I opened my mouth to say something else, but I had no words. Finally, deciding I just have to let this weirdness play out, I said okay and settled back into my seat. When we arrived at the house, I was awestruck by how beautiful it was. It was also very large, especially by Japanese house standards. We went through an outer gate and into a meticulously maintained garden. I gestured around and mouthed, "Spider," which got me a withering look as Kimiko mimicked my gesture and mouthed, "Gardener." I grinned and shrugged, and then we went on inside. The interior of their home put the outside to shame. It was spotless, but I wouldn't have expected less from Kimiko anyway, and it managed to be extremely clean and orderly without looking sterile or uninviting. I glanced around, simultaneously happy to be there and nervous. And finally, I asked where it was. Shrugging, she led me deeper into the house. It's hard to say. It keeps to itself mainly, and it won't ever approach you, even though it doesn't run if you approach it. I guess in theory it would let you touch it, but I've never tried. She gave out a short laugh. It sounds so weird actually talking about it with another person. She suddenly stopped and turned, giving me a quick hug. I'm really glad you're here. It wasn't until that evening, after we had eaten dinner and settled in the living room to watch TV, that I saw the yokai. I caught motion out the corner of my eye and started to turn when the shape I saw froze me in place. If anything, Kimiko had underestimated the thing's size. It moved silently into the room and slowly moved up a back wall until it was perched against the high ceiling. I heard Kimiko's voice near my ear, telling me to breathe, that it was okay. Just go ahead and look at it. It was fine. I didn't mind. With great effort, I turned my head more to see it fully, taking in its dark form and the flickering of the light from the television. It reminded me somewhat of a tarantula, but with large sets of black eyes, three smaller surrounding a larger, and on both sides of its face. I could feel it glance down at me for a moment, but then it seemed to go back to watching TV. If it had been anyone else, I would have run away then. As it was, I spent the next day trying to convince her that it wasn't safe for her to stay, and she spent another two convincing me everything was fine. Ultimately, she won out. I stayed for another 5 days, had a great time, and by the end I actually waved to the spider as it crept across the foyer the day I left to return home. It glanced at me again, gave a slight nod, and went about its strange business. By the time I arrived home, the entire trip seemed surreal. I was also exhausted. I put down my suitcase, cleared out a spot on my messy bed, and fell asleep. I woke up 5 hours later, and seeing the piles of clothes and the fury of dishes in the sink and the general messiness that I had only partially to blame on preparing for the trip, I found myself wishing I had a ghost spider maid of my own. Shaking away the thought, and after a depressing look into the fridge, I went out for pizza. When I got back, everything was pristine. I felt a combination of wonder and terror. Had the spider somehow followed me here? That's when I saw my suitcase. It had been set against a wall and emptied, but when I got closer, I could still see a small bulge in the front pocket at the top. The pocket was partway unzipped, and I used the light on my phone to look inside. There was an egg in there. A strange, leathery black egg, the size of a large chicken egg, its surface shiny except for the intermittent dull flecks of green. Even at a distance, I could see the egg had been opened from the inside and was empty. I ran outside and called Kimiko. She answered sleepily, but woke up fast when I told her what I'd found. She said her yokai was still there, but she guessed it had a baby. She said she would try and find out what she could, but to be very careful, as not all yokai are the same, and some are very dangerous. I debated getting a hotel room, but ended up going back in, promising myself I would run at the first sign of trouble. When I entered, I saw it. It was halfway up the wall on the front hall, looking at me with 8 small eyes of dark blue like sapphires. It was the size of a small kitten, and its legs and body were covered in what looked like white fur. Its head was the strangest part, as aside from its eyes, it looked more like the head of a weasel than a spider. I saw it open its mouth in a toothy yawn before giving me a small, warbling greeting. It was almost cute, which probably meant it would kill me and fill my body cavity with eggs. I regretted the thought and swallowed. Are we cool? I felt like an idiot, talking to a little monster on my wall, but I just blurted it out. Then it nodded. Going to live here together and get along and not hurt each other? Another nod. Okay. Cool, I guess. We'll try it out. Welcome home. The creature gave what I decided was a happy warble and nod before moving away down the hall. In the days since, everything has gone very well. It's still bizarre, of course, but I've adjusted quickly and had no real concerns until this morning when I found the body in the guest room closet. I'd gone upstairs to get a raincoat out of the closet, but I had trouble opening the door. When I did, I saw a man's body wrapped neatly in silk webbing, sitting in the closet floor. I screamed, but before going into full panic mode, I realized the man was wearing a black ski mask. I studied him closer to the extent I could see through the webs. He had dark clothes and a long, skinny knife was clenched in his right fist. I recognized that knife. Chet used to carry it around in his truck at the times he went out. I felt my stomach clench. I managed to slip the knife loose with some effort and used it to free enough webbing to remove the mask. Chet's face was hollowed and drawn, and I could see that his throat had been ripped out. It's hard for me to say how long he had been there, but I had seen enough to know what had happened. I grabbed my raincoat and went out. When I returned home that night, every trace of him was gone. For the 10th time, I considered calling the police, but what could I say? In the end, I sat down and turned on the television. It only took a minute to find a game show to watch. There was a viral outbreak on the International Space Station, and I'm the only person who remembers it. People are always impressed when they discover that I went to space. They seem to treat me differently, and it is a great chat-up line with women as well. I've often been asked to explain what it's like up there, but I generally give vague answers. Honestly, I would prefer to forget what happened, but it's burned into my memory. I was part of a crew sent up to make some repairs on the International Space Station. It was me and another guy, Gary, who were tasked with the repairs. I remember being so excited as we prepared to do our first spacewalk. Gary was laughing at me and telling me he was like a kid in a candy shop. The spacewalk was uneventful, and we got it done quicker than expected. We lost contact with everybody on board the station, but assumed that was an issue with our suits. Gary was cracking jokes as we took off our suits while I remained silent. I had this weird feeling that something was wrong, but I couldn't explain why. We entered the station, and I spotted one of the other crew floating there with his back to us. Gary began moving toward him, and I wanted to scream at him to stop, but the words caught in my throat. I watched in slow motion as Gary spun him around. His face was covered in a black liquid that seemed to be oozing out of every orifice. Gary began shrieking as the crew member opened its mouth and spewed the liquid directly into Gary's face. Gary's cries were cut short as the liquid made its way into his mouth. I began backing away slowly and collided with the toolbox, knocking its contents everywhere. I looked up to see both of them hurtling toward me as I ducked around a corner. I thought I was about to die after floating into a dead end. I turned to face them and was confused as they somehow moved by me without noticing me. I waited a few minutes before peeking my head out and almost wept myself as Gary was only inches from my face and staring directly at me. I expected him to attack me, but he just remained completely still. I moved my hands in front of his face and discovered that whatever was inside him couldn't see. I decided to use this knowledge to my advantage and began moving around the station as carefully as I could. I found the other crew members had also been infected and were scattered around the place. I'd planned to try and call for help, but all the radio equipment had been destroyed, leaving me isolated. The next few hours were arduous, as I was forced to hide numerous times as the others were searching for me. I was exhausted, but too terrified to sleep in case they found me. Eventually, I was unable to keep going and found a secluded corner and drifted to sleep. I awoke a short time after and began searching for a way to escape. I turned a corner and froze in place as Gary and the others were congregating around a table. They all had their hands raised in the air and the black liquid was flowing along their bodies. I let out an audible gasp as the liquid began pooling in the center of them. My eyes widened as their heads turned at once and faced toward me. I had to cover my ears as they began emitting an ear-splitting shriek that sent shivers down my spine, and I fled the room with the sounds of pursuit close behind. I ducked into another corridor and watched as they soared past me. It was only a matter of time before they would find me. I knew that my only choice was to do something drastic, as otherwise I wouldn't survive this. I made my way toward the spacesuits and put mine on. It would hopefully protect me from the black liquid. I made my way outside and found the nearest control console. I was deliberating what to do when I decided to just turn off the oxygen supply. I had enough oxygen in my suit to keep me going for a number of hours. I was running on fumes when I decided to turn on the oxygen again. I prayed that it had worked as I climbed back on board, wandering the corridors, finding the floating bodies of the other crew members with no sign of the black liquid. I made my way toward my bed, as I knew that I desperately needed to sleep. I had horrible nightmares of drowning in an endless black sea. I managed to suppress a scream as I was shaken awake by Gary. he or none of the others could remember anything that had happened over the last few days, and I didn't have the heart to tell him. We managed to get communications back up and running, and I almost wept tears of happiness as I stood on solid ground again. I never told anyone what happened up there, due to fear of being deemed crazy, but lately I've noticed a blackness moving around inside my eyeballs, and I fear I may have brought it down to Earth. There's a needle hunting me. Last year, I finished a 4-year residency as part of becoming an emergency medical specialist, an ER doctor. Working in a metropolitan hospital, I'd seen a lot of crazy things over time. Shootings, stabbings, freak accidents, and mysterious illnesses, to name a few. But the patient I remember the most was Martha Jennings. Martha had come in originally after police had been called to her home due to noise complaints from her neighbors. When the officers arrived, they'd found her frantically moving to and fro between a cellar door and a backed-up truck filled with sheets of metal and wood. According to one cop I spoke to later, she'd been wringing with sweat as she yanked an 8-foot sheet of plywood off the truck and began dragging it toward the doorway that led underneath the house. She barely looked up at the officers' arrival, but when they offered to help her carry it down, she accepted gratefully. The cellar was in chaos, with power tools and cords strewn across the floor from one end to the other. It didn't take long to figure out that Martha was in the process of adding layers to all the walls down there, and not just one layer either. Instead, she was attaching sheets of wood and metal and alternating panels, and in places, the layers were already 5 or 6 sheets deep. When the cop casually asked her what kind of project she was working on down there, she'd blinked several times before answering, her voice quiet and wavering in between pants of exertion as she propped the latest board against the wall. "I'm making the walls thicker, so it's safe down here for when it comes for me." That, naturally, followed up with more questions, which led to her being brought in for examination. She was brought to the ER first due to concerns that her confusion might be caused by either dehydration, heat stroke, or some kind of bad reaction to medicine. We pulled the blood and did an initial exam right after she arrived, but I wasn't noticing anything other than her being slightly underweight and looking exhausted. That and her being really pissed off. "You can't keep me here. You have no right. I haven't committed a crime, have I?" I smiled at her then, both because I wanted to reassure her and because I thought it was a fair question. I knew they had brought her in because she was being disorderly, but I honestly figured they did it more because they were worried about her and the things she was saying at the time. All I knew was that she had supposedly been acting crazy and talking out of her head, but looking at her now, fuming but clear-eyed, it was hard to imagine it. "No, I don't think you did anything wrong, but, well, I think we're scared something was wrong. That maybe you were sick or you weren't feeling yourself. Do you remember talking to the officers that brought you here?" She rolled her eyes. "Yes, I'm not crazy. Or if I am, I'm not senile at least." I laughed. "No one said you were. But do you mind telling me what you talked to them about? It may be some kind of misunderstanding." She sighed. "Look, I was having a bad day. I ran my mouth, and they took me for being serious. It was all a bad joke that got out of hand." She looked down at the wrist cuffs that secured her to the bed. "Can you take these off? They're itchy, and I promise you don't need them." Nodding, I unbuckled them as we talked. "So, it was a bad joke. Tell me about it. What did you tell them?" Rubbing her freed wrists, she scowled. I am, renovating the basement of my house. My husband died a few months ago, and I've been trying to keep busy ever since. I guess I was making too much noise, and one of my stupid neighbors complained. I was mad because they called the cops, and so I made up this silly story to mess with them. That's all there is to it. She glanced around. So can I get my clothes back? I'm ready to go now. I shook my head slightly. Miss Jennings, call me Martha, please. I'm not that old. Martha, I can't make the call to release you. When someone's brought in by the police, they have to either sign off on the release or they take you back when we're done treating you. I understand this might have just been a bad joke, like you said, but I'm going to have to talk to them first. She started arguing. I raised my hand. If you will, tell me what you told them, if you remember. It'll put you in a better position to help you get released if I know what we're talking about, okay? Martha closed her eyes and pushed her head back into the pillow, her lips a thin line of resigned defeat as she began. I told them that there is some kind of alien or magic needle or something that's haunting me. That I needed to make the walls of my basement thick enough that it couldn't get through, even though I didn't know if it would matter. I raised an eyebrow. So, that was your joke? That you thought the magic needle was after you? Glaring at me, she nodded. Yes. It was a bad and stupid joke. Will you please get me released now? I need to be going. As I said, it will be a little while. They're going to want to see the blood work before we release you, and I don't control what the cops do after that. But I don't mind talking to them and trying to help, like I said. Leaning forward, she stabbed a finger toward me. I'll sue. You understand me? I'm being held against my will, and I will sue. I shrugged. Ma'am, you do what you need to do, but I'm telling you, if they arrested you, it's going to be at least another couple of hours before you get out of here, one way or the other. Her eyes widened. No, I can't stay here that long. You goddamn idiots, you don't... She started to get up and I raised a hand to stop her. Please, don't. They'll just put the restraints back on you, and it'll make it harder for me to convince them that you're okay to go home. Can you try to be patient? I was surprised when she laid back, tears in her eyes. You're killing me. You're all killing me. That's what you're doing. Miss Martha, what do you mean? What are you afraid of? The tests? I can assure you they're all harmless and no one will do anything. No, you fool. It's not the test. Her voice was lower but more strident now, the angry hiss of a snake. The needle. The fucking needle. Her eyes darted around as she spoke. The needle is real. I lied before. The needle is real and it's coming for me. I need to keep moving or be somewhere protected, not stuck here talking to you. I felt new unease stirring in my belly. She wasn't joking now, and I didn't think she was lying either. Which meant she was crazy after all. I almost went out and got help right then, but I wanted to know more. Maybe she could tell me something that could help before they took her away for the 72-hour psych observation, as I could see now that's the direction this was all heading. Martha, will you tell me what you're talking about? The truth? It's the only way I can help. The woman looked at me for several moments before seeming to make a decision, scowling. She gave me a shrug. Why not? It won't make you think I'm any more crazy than you already do, and apparently I have at least a little bit of time to kill. For the record, this is all a joke. I do not consent to my restraints, and if I'm not released in the next few minutes, you can expect a lawsuit. These words lacked the same energy and conviction that had crackled off her just moments before. In fact, as I watched, she seemed to be deflating, her fear and panic replaced with the dull gray sheen of resignation that was somehow worse. I was going to ask if she was okay, but she'd already begun. My husband wasn't a bad man. A bit boring and clueless, yes, and too in love with his work to be sure, but not a mean bone in his body. He was passionate about his work. It was all molecular chemistry and metallurgy, and, well, it was interesting to him and the paint on the wall. But he paid well enough, especially when he got hired by a hush-hush outfit to work some secret project. When he first went to work there, I tried getting some details out of him, but he wouldn't budge. Too much work integrity, you see. They said, don't tell anything. So he didn't. That's how I knew things were bad when he came home 6 months ago, pale and shaking. It wasn't his constant, nervous glances. He'd been acting more jittery for weeks, and I assumed it was either work or stress because he knew our marriage was heading toward the edge of something that might interrupt the orderly existence he'd crafted himself for the last 10 years. It wasn't even the fact that he poured himself a drink as soon as he walked in, despite the fact that he never drank more than once or twice a year. It was the fact that he was talking to me, telling me things. Things I knew he wasn't supposed to be telling. Him breaking one of their precious rules scared the shit out of me. He said that for the last 3 years, he'd been part of Project Arcadia, a long-term multidisciplinary study of several objects provided to the group he worked for. When I asked if it was the government, he just laughed and shook his head. He said I watched too many movies and was thinking too small, but that it didn't matter. What mattered was what had happened 2 weeks earlier. What had happened 2 hours before he came home to me, terrified and shaking. And it all came down to the thing that his team had been working on for the past year. They called it the needle. 2 inches long in the width of 5 human hairs, was a straight line of metal that defied any kind of explanation. For one thing, the metal seemed indestructible. They couldn't even scrape it for a sample. And the tests they could run came back with results that made little sense and gave fewer answers. Second, it seemed to be solid and made of one piece, but all attempts at internal imaging had failed, so they couldn't say for sure. Third, and this is where I started to think he was crazy, the needle floated. Just floated on its own like a balloon, though it never raised or lowered itself more than about 4 feet off the ground, unless pushed. If you did push it, it would drift away like a floating bar of soap before slowly creeping back to its original spot. I asked him then, kind of making fun if I'm honest, if it was from an alien ship or something. He hadn't laughed, but only shook his head. Said he didn't know. They were only told to learn what they could about how it worked. But he'd added wearily, one of his partners had said it had come from some kind of benefactor. That the guy had worked on other objects before, and they were all different and strange. One had been some kind of mask, another was a tissue sample from a tree or something. For a long time, he enjoyed working with the needle. They made very little progress, but the chance to work with something so unique was exciting. He started staying longer and longer hours in the hopes of making some kind of breakthrough. He didn't say it, but I think he was afraid he'd be kicked off the project if they didn't get results. Joke was on him, wasn't it? Fuck, that's petty. He didn't know. I guess none of them did. But where was I? 2 weeks before my husband told me all this, they were doing a round of what he called behavioral test on the damn thing because they'd figured out it had to have some kind of computer in it or something because of how it acted. It was fine with being moved around to wherever, but it wanted to stay in the same height above the ground. They constructed big vertical mazes then it would navigate them. According to Reese, that was my husband, it was just like watching a smart rat after it had memorized the path. They had this this fucking thing, and they were just playing with it like it was a shiny toy. Except one day, when one of his buddies, Becker, was pushing the needle into the maze opening, his hand slipped and the needle pricked his finger. Reese said it never should have happened. They had protocols for handling this thing, but they'd gotten used to it, which made them careless and sloppy. For a few seconds, they were just laughing nervously as Becker sucked his bloody finger. Then they heard a terrible screeching sound as the needle pushed its way out of the maze, shot through a nearby wall, and disappeared. They were locked down for the next 12 hours, questioned again and again while security watched the surveillance videos and tracked the trajectory of the needle out of the facility. It had shot through dozens of walls before flying off to places unknown. Well, unknown for the time being. As far as Reese and the rest of them went, there was no signs of them doing anything to cause it other than Becker pricking his finger. The rest of them were reassigned while Becker was asked to remain at the facility for further testing until the investigation was complete. Reese heard about the first of the killings a couple days later. Becker had a grandmother in Arizona. She suddenly dropped dead in the produce department of her local grocery store, the only visible injury a tiny well of blood on the front and back of her head as though she'd been pricked by something. The next day, Becker's high school girlfriend, who he'd apparently hadn't seen for years, died in a single car accident with no apparent cause for the wreck. By that weekend, his brother and the brother's entire family were found dead in their camper of indeterminate causes. Then it was Becker's college roommate, his parents, his fucking pharmacist. Because of the way the grandmother died, they suspected from the start that it was the needle. And while they didn't know why it was doing what it was doing, they began to understand the pattern and the practical effect. It was killing off anyone connected to the man who had pricked his finger on it. 2 hours before he came home, Reese had been talking to one of his old lab partners. They were on different teams now, and this was the first time they talked in a few days. Reese said the first thing he noticed was that Teresa was spilling her coffee. He went to mention it when he realized she wasn't spilling it at all. There was a small hole in the side of her mug. As the cup fell away, he saw blood blooming on her shirt as she fell to the ground. I remember him saying that she shouldn't have died so fast, not unless it had darted around inside her before flitting away again. Reese was killed 2 days after telling me about the needle. His death was a bit more mundane, however, as he was shot to death in a robbery while coming back from the ice machine at the motel where we had checked into that night. Apparently, his employers weren't very happy with him spoiling the beans and trying to run away from the killer needle. I'd expected to follow him soon after, but no one ever came. No assassins or black cars following me or whatever it was they might normally do. I moved around for a few days, but I realized there was no point. They could find me if they wanted, and I'd started to figure out that they didn't want to kill me after all. No, they were content to let the needle do that for them while they gathered the data. Another fucking behavioral test. So I went back home. That's when I got the call that Rory, the man I'd been sleeping with for the past 3 years, had died mysteriously in the shower. Rory, a man that Reese had never met, let alone Becker. That's when I knew that Reese had been telling the truth and that sometime, somewhere, the needle would be coming for me. That's why I have to get out of here. I tried to keep my expression neutral as Martha finished her story. It was insane, of course, but letting my disbelief and pity show would have only upset her more. So instead, I thanked her and told her I needed to finish my rounds, but I would be back shortly. She said something else as I walked away, but I pretended I didn't hear it and kept going. I was on the other side of the ER a few minutes later when I heard Martha begin to scream. Running over, I pushed through a throng of nurses and PAs to see what was bad enough to cause her to scream so loudly for a few seconds before falling silent. My breath caught as I saw her dead eyes staring up at the ceiling, the right one red from hemorrhage. I staggered back a step, and that's when I noticed her bare foot hanging halfway off the bed. On the bottom of her heel was a tiny drop of blood. When I wiped at it, I saw a small puncture wound there. I was moving back toward her upper body to more closely examine the injured eye when something on the wall behind the bed caught my attention. It was a small hole, about the width of 5 human hairs. It looked to be lined up perfectly with the top of Martha's head. When I checked, I found a matching hole in her scalp. I went home early that night. I couldn't get her story out of my head, but worse was the sound of her scream, full of fear and pain as the thing she feared the most found her and pushed its way relentlessly through her body. I checked later, and there was no autopsy, no record of who claimed the body or where it went. It didn't matter. I suspected I knew exactly who had taken it. The next few months were hard for me. I kept waiting for guys in black suits to pay me a visit or to wake up in a dungeon somewhere. I kept my head down, finished my residency, and moved to the other side of the country. When I started my new job, I didn't take more than a day off for the first 6 months, and it was only this weekend that I actually got away with the girl I've been seeing. It's the first time in a really long time that I've relaxed. When I got home, I realized I'd gone more than 24 hours without feeling scared for the first time in, well, a long time. Laying down in my bed, I felt myself getting drowsy as I stared up at my ceiling. Things were going good with Cindy, and work was fine now that there was a hole in my ceiling. I sat up and looked closer. I hadn't been there before. There hadn't been a hole right above my bed, right over where I laid my head. I looked around in a panic. There were no signs of anything else being disturbed, but still, I stood up and examined my bed. That's when I noticed there was a singular hole in my pillow through when I picked it up. It didn't go through the other side, as though it realized I wasn't there. Or it was letting me know that it had been. Shaking, I grabbed my suitcase again, headed for the bus station, and got on the first one that was going far with infrequent stops. Planned infrequent stops, at least. Because as I'm writing this on my phone, the bus had pulled over in the middle of nowhere. A flat tire and engine trouble, if you can believe that coincidence. I know I can't. There's no service out here, so the driver is walking back to a spot in the road with a gas station that we passed a couple of miles back. I'm not waiting on that, though. I'm going to start walking the opposite direction as soon as this is finished. Not because I think I'll outrun it, you understand, but because people get nervous in a crisis, or even just the inconvenience of being stranded for a couple of hours. They want to talk, get to know each other, make connections so they feel more normal and less alone. I'm already terrified about what may happen to Cindy and my Uncle Mike, the people I work with or I've treated. I don't want more lives on my conscience. So I'll walk and hope it doesn't find me. And if it does, it will end with me. And if it's coming for me, I hope it's soon. Because I remember the last thing Martha said to me as I walked away, pretending I didn't hear. The worst part isn't that it's coming, you see. It's not knowing when or why. That it's out there, taking its time, maybe enjoying itself, enjoying thinking about when it catches you. When it catches you and pushes a hole right on through. Last year I finished a 4-year residency. This is what happens when I record at 8:30 in the fucking morning.